Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Sunday, June 7th, and we have today's reading of the Boston Herald being read to you by William. Good morning, William.
Good morning, Billy. And good morning, listeners, to the Talking Information Center's reading of the Boston Sunday Herald for June 7th, 2026. From the front page, summertime chill, construction slowdown cooling city revenue, study says. Under the heading City Review, construction slowdown drives a budget crunch, the study says, by Gayla Cawley. A new City Hall watchdog report highlights how declining property tax revenue tied to lagging construction activity is straining Boston's $4.9 billion budget. The Boston Municipal Research Bureau report comes as the City Council considers how to amend the mayor's proposed budget to restore grant funding cuts that have led to community backlash. The council will vote on the budget Wednesday after delaying the vote a week. The Research Bureau notes that the slowdown in revenue limited fiscal year spending and budget growth for 2027, with property taxes growing at the slowest rate since fiscal year 1998. Mayor Michelle Wu's proposed budget grew by 2.1% over this fiscal year, the lowest rate of growth since the Great Recession in fiscal year 2010. The property tax, Boston's most important source of revenue, accounts for 73.1% of the city's fiscal year 27 revenue. The BMRB report states net property is expected to increase 3.6% from fiscal year 27, the lowest level in nearly 30 years since fiscal year 98. This increase in property tax revenue is significantly below the average of 5.4% over the last 5 years. What's causing the property tax growth to slow to a trickle, as the report puts it, is lagging construction characterized in budgetary and tax terms as new growth. New growth, which has driven the city's increase in property tax base over the last two decades and has allowed the tax levy to rise well above 2.5% each year, is budgeted at $40 million, the report states. While in line with the city's previous conservative budgeting practices, this represents the lowest new growth projection since fiscal year 16 and is down from the $60 million budgeted for the last 4 years. The reduced new growth figure acknowledges a new reality for the city. Decreased construction activity is leading to reduced growth in property taxes, the report added. In fiscal year 26, for this fiscal year, new growth was down 35.9% from the fiscal year 24 peak of $121.8 million in commercial new growth. At $30.9 million, now accounts for less than half of the amount from fiscal year 24, the report states. Such declines are evident in part through a sharp decrease in developers taking out building permits from City Hall for new construction, per the court. The fiscal year 27 budget projects sharp declines in interest on investments and building permits, which are sensitive to economic conditions, the report states. Taken together, declines in building permits and interest on investments represent a loss of $51.9 million from fiscal year 26, which tempered overall revenue growth to just 2.1% in fiscal year 27. Mayor Wu's critics have stated that her policies, like increased affordability and green energy requirements for new development, are to blame for lagging construction in Boston. We are not listening to the repeated feedback we've received for years from the development and business community on why we're not building any housing in Boston anymore, City Councilor Ed Flynn said Thursday in a statement. They're not investing because the city added increased affordable environmental requirements, as well as fear of rent control on top of already tough business environment of post-pandemic inflation. High interest rates, increased construction costs, and tariffs, Flynn added. Flynn cited unspecified data that show Boston's housing production plummeted from 9,800 units approved in 2020 to just 852 in the first 6 months of 2025. Our affordable housing crisis cannot wait several years for the worldwide economy to improve, Flynn said. In the meantime, the demand for housing and affordable housing will only increase. Supply will continue to drop, home values and property taxes will increase, and we will have wasted more time. The Research Bureau report notes that revenue from building permits, the price of which are tied to the cost of construction, is expected to decrease sharply by 24.5% or $12.1 million in the next fiscal year that begins on July 1st. It states that the projected $37.2 million for building permits revenue in fiscal year 27 would be the lowest amount since fiscal year 13, reflecting a sobering outlook for the local economy. The decline in building permits is an indicator of economic growth and a harbinger of the city's expected decline in construction activity for fiscal year 27, the report states. While tax revenue and federal aid are slowing due to the expiration of federal pandemic relief funding, costs like personnel, health insurance, and police overtime are rising, the report said. About 70% of the city's budget consists of city employee salaries and benefits, along with discretionary costs, per the report. Personnel services included reserves for future collective bargaining agreements continues to be the largest expenditure for the city and accounts for 61% of the proposed budget, with health insurance costs occupying an additional 9.7% of the fiscal year 27 budget, the report states. Mayor Wu created 301 new positions in her first 3 years in office, 97 of whom earned more than $100,000, and has continued to do so this year amid a budget crunch. The Research Bureau cautioned, as the city enters a new low-growth environment that is likely to limit revenue in the foreseeable future, Boston should examine structural and strategic steps needed for its long-term financial health. The city had to dip into its $1.7 billion emergency reserve fund to cover a $70 million budget shortfall this year. The last time it did so was during the pandemic in fiscal year 21 to cover a $40 million deficit. End of article. Politicians and politics. Massachusetts makes the fourth highest contributions to Maine's Senate candidate, Plattner. Democratic platform Act Blue has donated $3.6 million to his Senate campaign. By Tim Dunn. Massachusetts accounts for the fourth most contributions out of all 50 states sent to controversial Maine U.S. Senate candidate Graham Plattner's campaign. With a Democratic Party PAC based in Somerville, sending him an eye-popping $3.6 million to date. The backing for the Bay State comes as Plattner has been embroiled in personal controversies ranging from now infamous tattoo of a Nazi symbol to alleged sexual messages sent to women on the Kick app while he was married. In other past actions and statements, Act Blue, the Massachusetts-based fundraising platform and political action committee for the Democratic Party, has processed $3,647,247 in earmarked individual contributions to the Plattner campaign to date, according to the latest Federal Election Commission filings. A handful of professors from MIT, UMass and other universities have also sent individual contributions to Platina in their own names, with the largest individual contribution as high as $7,000, an amount sent by the likes of Harvard-based multimillionaire philanthropist Kenneth Nickerson and his wife, Catherine Deist, among others, according to the FEC. Douglas Sharp, the general manager of a Concord-based radio station, sent the campaign a $5,000 check. About a dozen or so lawyers and capital investment managers contributed amounts in the $3,500 range, records show. Massachusetts only ranks behind Maine, California, and New York in contribution to Platner's campaign. The support for Platina in Massachusetts is not limited to finances, with the state's prominent politicians publicly expressing their support for Platina or flat-out endorsing him. Most recently, Governor Maura Healey publicly backed Platina during a Tuesday appearance on GPH Radio, stating that Platina has her support in a November general election matching against Senator Susan Collins. Yes, I'll tell you why. I'm disgusted by what he posted, and I'm disgusted by his other behaviors and antics. But here's the thing. Come November, there's going to be a clear choice. There's going to be Susan Collins on one hand, who has stood up with Trump, Healey said to GBH host Jim Brody. Just hours later, Healey doubled down on her support for Platina whilst trying to walk back the endorsement she gave earlier on the radio. The person I endorsed in this race was my colleague, Governor Janet Mills. We also served together as Attorney General. She is on the ballot. What I've said, too, is come November, we need to do everything we can to defeat Senator Susan Collins. Healey said when pressed by the Herald on how she could support a candidate embroiled in such controversy as Platina. Mills suspended her campaign in April, but still remains on the ballot as Maine's primary election falls on Tuesday. Senator Elizabeth Warren has been the most vocal supporter of Platina in Massachusetts, fully backing his candidacy along with Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent from Vermont. Sanders and Warren have co-hosted multiple campaign speeches for Platina throughout Maine and have advocated for him in national television interviews over the past month. In a Thursday appearance on CNN, Congressman and U.S. Senate candidate Seth Moulton echoed the anti-Susan Collins sentiment for a reason for Maine voters to elect Platina while avoiding answering any questions whether Platina should end his campaign if more controversial actions of his are unearthed. I mean, we just don't know. We just don't know what's more to come out. But I do know this, that he's running against a senator who's every single day rubber stamps President Trump's agenda, a senator who, just like 98% of the Republican Party, supports this war in Iran that's raising everybody's gas prices. That's getting Americans killed, Moulton said on CNN News Central with Kate Baldwin. So all of these things that Susan Collins does every single day are bad. And I think voters in Maine are going to have to make a decision that only they can make, weighing those alternatives, he said. Appearing on the same CNN program Thursday, Senator Ed Markey notably dodged endorsing the scandal-plagued Platina, complimenting the Maine candidate's platform and his opposition to President Donald Trump and his policies while falling short of giving an endorsement. I know that he is out and he is campaigning on kitchen table issues. I know that he's opposed to this slush fund that Donald Trump is putting together. He's putting affordability front and center for the voters of Maine to decide this race. And I think that he has the right issues to be focusing upon this year in Maine, Markey said before being pressed by host Boris Sanchez. In my opinion, he has taken the issues and he's galvanized a grassroots movement all across Maine. People are responding to town meetings. They are up. They're energized. And in my opinion, he is on the pathway to victory in the state of Maine, he responded. Plattner's campaign was present at the Massachusetts Democrat Convention in Worcester. Plattner staffers shared table space with Markey's campaign as they displayed campaign signs and solicited donations from volunteers. Turning to the next column, meet some of Governor Mayor Healey's favorite residents. Today we begin a new feature called Meet the Residents. Last week, Governor Maura Healey bemoaned the actions of Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Massachusetts. The governor is outraged that federal law enforcement has been rounding up some of her most devoted supporters, often just as their EBT welfare cards are being reloaded for the month. And before the bloodthirsty cholos can even obtain mail-in ballots to fraudulently vote in the straight Democrat ticket to keep the free stuff coming. I'd like to see from ICE, Maura bitterly complained, an actual accounting of the residents who've been taken. Governor, your wish is our command. Let us begin with resident Joko Herbert Thomas from Sierra Leone. Massachusetts law is a joke to Joko. Check out his African rap sheet, according to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. He has been arraigned on 50 separate adult charges. Since 1996, Thomas has only been committing the crimes Americans can no longer be bothered committing. Next, Governor, meet resident Christian Lopez Encinio from Guatemala. Like Joseph, in the Old Testament, he was wearing a coat of many colors when lugged by ICE in Chelsea. Do you like the Cholo's glad rags? I guarantee you that paid for his coat, gringo. Christian was too busy stabbing a juvenile in what's now known as El Salvador to work for a living like the Americans do. Pending charges, ICE noted, included assault with intent to murder and assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. Maura Healey positively swoons over all these residents. They're working. They are paying taxes, she gushes. They're raising kids. They're running businesses, contributing to our economy, and they've been taken away. The city of Quincy is no doubt reeling from the removal of Weeds Kenny Alexandre Cadet from Haiti. Does this dreadlocked resident look like he's been paying a lot of taxes and contributing to our economy? Cadet's criminal history. Immigration and Customs Enforcement notes that the ERO Boston X-Feed includes pending charges for rape and a probation violation. In addition to the word rape, another recurring theme in his rap sheet is dangerousness. Also, police report impounded. That's SOP for rape cases. A few more phrases from the court in all caps. Do not bail until hooked to GPS. Do not bail until passport is surrendered. During his taxpayer-funded crime wave, Weeds was fortunate to be coddled by an ancient crackpot Dukakis judge in Quincy over and over again. But his voodoo streak of good luck finally ran out when ICE lugged him. Quincy's gain and Port-au-Prince's loss. Maura Healey is no doubt heartbroken. Then there's resident Lucas Gustavo Barack Almeida Di Benedetto. Have you noticed one of the quaint cultural traditions these savages have brought with them from their primitive homelands in addition to the machete attacks and the underage rapes of female offspring? I refer, of course, to drunk driving the wrong way on major highways after midnight. The above-mentioned Cholo from Brazil was charged with striking a state police cruiser last week on Route 1. It was the second such third-world OUI of the month. The first one resulted in the death of a trooper at the hands of an intoxicated, naturalized American from south of the border. This freeloading fiend, DiBenedetto, had been flopping here since 2007. After he almost killed a cop, his Democrat comrades in court instantly cut him loose on $500 bail. $500 for driving the wrong way drunk on Route 1 and putting a cop in the hospital. After lugging the cholo outside the courthouse, ICE issued this statement. He was released from jail by sanctuary politicians before Immigration and Customs Enforcement could take enforcement action. Adios, amigo. No doubt he's out driving drunk again this weekend, using his welfare check to buy more cervezas, if not for what Maura Healey calls the shenanigans of a rogue agency, namely ICE. Democrats never dare to criticize any of these third world monsters, only the cops trying to protect American taxpayers from their cruel depredations. Instead of thanking ICE for performing the public service that she and her fellow Democrats refused to, Healey changed the subject to vowing to immediately expand wrong-way driving detection systems. Maura, the most effective way to stop wrong-way drunk driving around here would be to deport every last one of these illegal aliens. That would save countless American lives, not to mention billions of taxpayers' dollars squandered on welfare for these lawless invaders. That's the good news. The bad news is such a crackdown would cost Maura Healey, Wu, and the rest of the Democrats all the countless votes cast by illegals in the state's welfare industrial complex. Drunk, criminal, illegal residents versus law-abiding American taxpayers. I think we all know whose side Maura and the rest of the Democrats are on. And that was Howie Carr. In the next article from Washington, D.C., the FBI fires several analysts tied to the disputed Catholic ideology memo by Eric Tucker, Alana Durkin-Richer of the Associated Press. Several FBI analysts tied to the creation of the 2023 memo warning of a potential threat from Catholic violent extremists were fired on Friday, according to their lawyer. The latest wave of terminations under the leadership of Director Kash Patel. The fired employees included four intelligence analysts and a supervisory analyst. The FBI declined to comment. This action is manifestly unjust, completely unsupported by facts, and subverts standard FBI policy and procedure, their lawyer, David Loffman, said in a statement. These individuals deserve far better for their exceptional and faithful public service they rendered to protect our country. In January of 2023, intelligence product produced by analysts in the FBI's Richmond, Virginia field office emerged as a political flashpoint after it was issued, with Republicans in Congress repeatedly citing it as part of their broader contention that the FBI during the Biden administration was targeting conservatives. Then-Director Chris Wray repeatedly denied that charge, and the FBI said the document was quickly retracted and internal review was launched. Merrick Garland, the Attorney General under President Joe Biden, has said he was appalled by the memo. Earlier, Justice Department investigations into the memo challenged the analytical tradecraft, but did not find intentional misconduct by the analysts involved. The firings are part of a broader personal purge under Kash Patel. A Trump loyalist who over the last year has pushed out dozens of employees who either contributed to investigations of President Trump or were perceived to not be in alignment with the administration's agenda. The Justice Department has engaged in similar sweeping firings of prosecutors since President Trump took office. In February, for instance, the FBI fired up a group of counterintelligence agents who participated in the investigation in President Trump over his retention of classified documents at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, Florida. The Richmond memo, which emerged from a domestic terrorism investigation, sought to examine a potential link between what is called radical traditionalist Catholic ideology and radically and ethnically motivated extremists. It warned of the potential for violence and also highlighted what the author described as a new avenue for tripwire and source development. FBI leadership quickly condemned those findings once the document became public. An initial FBI review described in the 2023 letter to Congress and based on interviews with 26 people found that all individuals involved in the creation, review, and approval of the product failed to adhere to analytical tradecraft standards and failed to recognize that the product, as drafted, equated the subject's interest in their self-described form of a religion with radically and ethnically motivated violent extremists. Ideology without sufficient evidence or actual support. The failure to adhere to standards, including on proper domestic terrorism terminology, created the appearance that the FBI conducts investigative activity based on religious affiliation, the letter said. One of the FBI's most fundamental principles is that the investigative activity may not be based solely on the exercise of rights guaranteed by the First Amendment. A Justice Department Inspector General report in 2024 summarized the earlier FBI review by saying that though there were no departures from proper analytical tradecraft, no evidence of a malicious intent or an improper purpose were found. MS Now earlier reported the firings. Tucker reported from Los Angeles. End of article. Our next article, under the heading Karen Reed Case, Lawsuit Relitigates Claims of Police Conspiracy by Flint McCulkin. Karen Reed filed her lawsuit against Canton and the Massachusetts State Police not only to reveal shockingly obscene and racist text messages between key cops investigating her, but also to relitigate the defense theory of conspiracy to frame her. The lawsuit filed in Bristol Superior Court on Thursday details 7 civil counts against the Massachusetts State Police and the town of Canton. Those are count 1, negligence against the Massachusetts State Police. Count 2, negligence against Canton through the Canton Police. And count 3, civil conspiracy against the Massachusetts State Police and Canton. But the complaint, including a medley of exhibits, included a full text of Reed's federal lawsuit. Those exhibits named names, and not just fired trooper Michael Proctor, the lead investigator against her, and Canton Police Sergeant Sean Good, who resigned last week. They're the pair allegedly responsible for the vile text that Reed's attorneys say revealed themselves as inveterate bigots, and explain this unfitness for any position of public trust. The federal lawsuit filed last November and amended in March lists as its defendants Proctor, Massachusetts State Police Sergeant Yuri Bukenik, Massachusetts State Police Lieutenant Brian Tully, who has also since taken early retirement, retired Boston cop Brian Albert, Nicole Albert, Jennifer McCabe, and Matthew McCabe, and Brian Higgins. Reed was charged with the murder of Boston police officer John O'Keefe, her boyfriend at the time, whose body was found frozen in the snow outside of Albert's home in the early morning of January 29th of 2022. Over 2 trials, which ultimately concluded last summer with her acquittal on all charges, save for an OUI, her attorneys alleged a law enforcement conspiracy to frame her for O'Keefe's death and to protect third-party conspirators who they say were actually to blame. Specifically, defense attorneys pointed towards Brian Albert, the fellow cop whose lawn O'Keefe's body was found, his buddy Brian Higgins, an ATF agent, and Colin Albert, who was a teenager at the time, as possible suspects. The Albert and McCabe families have filed a defamation suit against both Reed and one of her biggest boosters, Aidan Kearney, who blogged in promotion of her innocence under the name Turtle Boy, and who faces witness intimidation charges related to the Reed case. The defamation suit filed in April alleges the two orchestrated a sweeping years-long campaign to falsely implicate them in the O'Keefe death, in order to help Reed avoid responsibility for causing O'Keefe's death. Reed's own new suit doubles down as a conspiracy her lawyers presented at trial, saying the Massachusetts State Police and the Canton Police unleashed these two misogynist bigots, Proctor and Good, on Miss Reed to work on the conflicted and corrupt investigation into the death of Mr. O'Keefe. The complaint says these two cops and their departments understood the assignment once their fellow cops and friends, Brian and Nicole Albert, Matthew and Jennifer McCabe, and Brian Higgins, referred to as house defendants in Miss Reed's pending federal court action, falsely reported that Mr. O'Keefe never went inside the house. The complaint continues. Law enforcement began immediately targeting and framing the female outsider, Mrs. Reed, or Ms. Reed. The new suits detail sordid behavior by the investigators, including that Proctor referred to Reed as retarded and a whack job C-word with no ass, and his foregone conclusion even before investigation that she had zero chance of skating, which all came out at trial and eventually led to his firing from the Massachusetts State Police. And that immediately after Ms. Reed's arrest, Good made the same type of sexualized and dehumanizing comment about Ms. Reed's medical condition and physical appearance that he and Proctor peddled in the hallways of their organizations on a daily basis. Jesus, every girl will want a brain tumor, multiple sclerosis, colitis if you can look like that in yoga pants after killing your boyfriend, they said. The suit connects the details of the obscene text and extraordinarily unprofessional behavior of the cops involved to alleged negligence of the Massachusetts State Police and the Canton Police Department, and says the complaint transcends Ms. Reed's personal and actionable grievance. Rather, it is a clarion call for reform and accountability. Cloaked with the emblem of authority, the Massachusetts State Police and the Canton Police Department and their employees, Proctor and Good and others, betrayed their sworn commitment to uphold the law. The suit had immediately political effects even before the first hearing. Norfolk DA Michael Morrissey, who has been under fire for his office's handling of the Reed case, is not running for re-election. And the text message revelations have two candidates calling for his immediate resignation. Candidate Alan Dietz, a former federal prosecutor, issued a new statement calling for Morrissey to resign effective immediately. Another candidate, Juna Perkins, who reached out to the Herald to reissue her similar call from last June. Michael Morrissey has shown that he is no longer fit to lead the Norfolk County District Attorney's Office, Perkins wrote in a statement. Residents of Norfolk County, victims of crime, and those in our criminal justice system deserve better. I am calling on D.A. Morrissey to resign effective immediately, to ensure the restoration of justice and integrity in the district attorney's office. Also under the Karen Reed case, former Massachusetts State Police Trooper Proctor's attorneys to be pressed on deposition delay in a lawsuit by Lance Reynolds. Attorneys for Michael Proctor will have to answer in court when the disgraced former state trooper became unavailable for a scheduled deposition in Karen Reed's wrongful death suit. The attorneys will also be pressed on when Reed's legal team was informed of the request to delay Monday's deposition and why preparation couldn't take place on Friday or over the weekend. Plymouth County Judge Mark Gilday has scheduled a Zoom hearing for 8:45 a.m. on Monday for Proctor's team to answer questions in response to its last-minute request filed after 2 p.m. on Friday. Proctor's deposition has been scheduled for 9 a.m. on Monday. The push to delay the deposition out of a court interview in which a witness in a lawsuit answers questions under oath but without the presence of a judge came a day after Reed sued the Massachusetts State Police and the town of Canton. At the heart of the complaint are scores of racist and obscene texts allegedly shared between Proctor, the lead investigator in the failed murder case against Ms. Reed, and the former Canton Police Sergeant Sean Good. Reed, acquitted for the murder of her Boston cop boyfriend, John O'Keefe, argues that the explosive text messages between the two cops reveal that state police and town of Canton built a culture of bias and corruption, and they tolerated and hid from the public. Reed was already allowed to use the messages in the wrongful death suit that the O'Keefe family filed against her in August of 24. Proctor's attorney, Matthew Hamill, argued that the motion for a protective order to delay his client's deposition on Monday was supported by ample good cause, citing scheduling conflicts within the legal team and Proctor's personal circumstances. Monday's deposition was scheduled on April 3rd when Proctor's legal team accepted service of a subpoena, Hamill wrote in his motion. He added that Reed's counsel was advised on Friday of a scheduling conflict. Mr. Proctor is not a party to this matter, Hamill wrote. He is, at best, a mere fact witness. Although Ms. Reed has litigated this case extensively in the media, to the best of the undersigned's knowledge, only 3 depositions have been taken in this case. Ms. Reed's desired litigation strategy aside, the attorney added, Mr. Proctor will be produced for his deposition, but the previously agreed upon date of June 8th of 2026 is no longer workable due to a variety of circumstances as described further herein. End of article. Next, under the heading Motor Terrors, police confront dangerous and reckless teenage e-bike riders by Lance Reynolds. A Massachusetts police department is dropping the hammer on a rise in dangerous and reckless teenage e-bike riders as it has arrested 3 juveniles just this week. The Attleboro Police Department says it responded to 27 incidents of juveniles riding e-bikes in a manner that prompted complaints in May alone, bringing the total to roughly 143 responses since November of 2024. Most of this activity has been instances of reckless riding, the department said in a release on Thursday, saying as playing chicken with motorists, popping wheelies in opposing lanes, and riding in and out of traffic. These riders also engage in conduct in which they try to provoke operators of motor vehicles on city streets into physical altercations. The department added, as well as attempting to provoke the police into engaging in dangerous pursuits. Riders often record the stunts to post on social media, the department said. Just this week, the department has charged 3 juveniles in related incidents, including one on Tuesday night who intentionally drove directly towards a marked police cruiser. In order to avoid a head-on collision with the rider, the department said the officer had to come to a complete stop in traffic, at which point the rider at the last minute steered away from the cruiser, narrowly avoiding a collision. As the rider passed, it added, it was obvious that he was holding a cell phone or similar recording device, video recording this stunt. The police tried to stop the e-bike after the dangerous conduct as the rider continued to speed away before stopping and beginning to shout expletives at the officer, an action the department described as obvious attempt to provoke the officer to pursue the e-bike. Other officers arrived at the scene trying to distract the rider's attention from the initial responding officer. A detective reportedly grabbed the rider's arm to take him into custody, but the teenager tried to accelerate the e-bike from the complete stop before he fell off the vehicle. The rider, later identified as 16-year-old city resident, then spewed a torrent of obscenities at the officers while being secured in handcuffs, creating even more of a disturbance, the department said. Police seized the e-bike and charged the teenager with assault and battery by means of a dangerous weapon, negligent operation of a motor vehicle, resisting arrest, disorderly conduct, and disturbing the police. On Wednesday night, police arrested two other juveniles, a 16-year-old and a 17-year-old, who the department says are known associates of the teenager arrested the night before. The associates were allegedly attempting to break into the police department's outdoor storage area, used to house large items such as bicycles and e-bikes when they are seized as evidence. Attleboro is not the only Bay State Police Department dealing with unruly teenage e-bike rider behavior. The Falmouth Police Department in particular issued an advisory last month on juvenile bicycle and e-bike safety, outlining state regulations around increasingly popular vehicles. With warmer weather here, we're seeing an increase in unsafe bicycle and e-bike operation, particularly involving juveniles, the Falmouth Police Department stated in a Facebook post. Governor Maura Healey has filed a bill that will require an annual inspection, liability insurance, and an official Massachusetts license plate for high-speed motorized bicycles. That includes certain e-bikes, scooters, and mopeds. The bike would also ban the emerging product from bike lanes and walking and biking paths. Micro-mobility is already a part of how people get to work, school, and around communities, Healey said in a statement last month. But right now, the rules are unclear and inconsistent. We are seeing too much reckless behavior, more crashes and close calls, and too many people, especially pedestrians and young riders, are at risk. In April, the Long Meadow Police Department stated that it had seen a massive surge in e-bikes on our streets lately, as it tried to clear up confusion between e-bikes and mopeds. Massachusetts defines e-bikes as vehicles with operable pedals, a motor of 750 watts or less, and a maximum assisted speed of 20 miles per hour. The bottom line, if your e-bike functions like a motorcycle or a scooter, you must follow moped laws, Long Meadow Police Department stated in a Facebook post. Riding an unregistered, high-speed vehicle without a license puts you and our community at risk. That came after an incident in Milford in late March when police there responded to a call about a 15-year-old who crashed into a motor vehicle, marking the seventh e-bike-related incident in 10 days. We are once again urging our community to educate your children on the significant safety risks to riders and pedestrians. If proper laws and safety precautions are not taken, Milford Police Chief Robert Tuzino said in a statement at the time, if this trend continues, it will unquestionably result in tragedy. End of article. Under the heading of U.S. Treasury Department, banks warned of red flags tied to customers here illegally. Treasury's Financial Crimes Arm wants banks to help identify payroll schemes tied to people living in the country illegally as part of the Trump administration's latest measure to clamp down on illegal immigration. The Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, also known as FinCEN, issued an advisory Friday to banks that tell them to watch out for identity theft, payroll tax fraud, and money laundering schemes tied to hiring unauthorized workers. This comes after President Donald Trump in May signed an executive order that requires banks to take a closer look at the citizenship of their customers. The order directs bank regulators and government departments to look for signs that people without legal status are opening accounts or obtaining loans or credit cards. However, the order is less aggressive than banks had previously expected, as earlier reports suggested that the White House was drafting an order that would make collecting customer citizens' information mandatory. Still, without encouraging a blanket debanking of broad segments of the population, the order and latest advisory acts to discourage people in the United States illegally from interacting with larger U.S. financial systems. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said in a statement that the Trump administration will not allow illegal aliens to abuse financial institutions to steal billions of dollars from hardworking American taxpayers. Schemes to pay unlawful workers often rely upon access to U.S. financial systems, including U.S. banks, he said. Since banks have never collected any information about their customers, citizenship, or immigration status, there are no reliable public figures on how much risk these customers pose to financial systems. The banking industry has been aggressively lobbying for months to stop the White House from issuing an executive order that would have made collecting customers' citizenship status mandatory, arguing it would be expensive and require vast amounts of paperwork. Since the order only offered guidance to the banks instead of a mandate, it appears the banks were able to win over the White House. The advisory calls on financial institutions to be alert for more than a dozen so-called red flags that indicate an individual is in the U.S. illegally. End of article. And now today's Herald editorial. A breakdown in the criminal justice system. Con artists steal millions every year from vulnerable Americans, but it increasingly appears that the real money is ripping off the U.S. taxpayer. As bank robbers Willie Sutton famously said, that's where the money is. Some experts put the total amount of federal and state COVID money that ended up in the hands of fraudsters at nearly $1 trillion. Others estimate that $500 billion in federal spending is diverted by charlatans each year. Republicans in the White House have made it a point during President Donald Trump's second term to tighten the rules on various federal programs to attack such brazen thievery. This shouldn't be controversial, yet it is. Some Democrats argued that efforts to combat fraud risk making it more difficult for the poor to access government services. But isn't it equally important to ensure that the federal programs are run efficiently and that taxpayer money is directed to the people it is supposed to help rather than siphoned off by criminals? This week, CBS News reported on the case of one serial fraudster in California. Paul Rando was out on bond awaiting sentencing after being convicted for the sixth time on federal fraud charges. When he started his latest scheme, he was caught and, in April, pleaded guilty of diverting more than $270 million in Medicaid money. He'll be sentenced this summer and faces up to 30 years in prison. Obviously, there's a breakdown in the criminal justice system if this guy was able to have six convictions and never did any real prison time. Billy S.A. Lee, the top federal prosecutor in Los Angeles, told the network, S.A. Lee noted that Randall was living like a king off of us. One data company CEO told CBS that the U.S. government routinely falls prey to international criminals who steal billions in taxpayers' money and quickly whisk it out of the country. It goes to Russia, it goes to China, it goes to Nigeria, it goes to Romania, said Haywood Talkov, head of LexiNexis Risk Solutions Government. He added that American taxpayers are funding transnational criminals. Yet some states, particularly those run by Democrats, continue to downplay the administration's efforts to crack down on criminals who see the U.S. Treasury as a piggy bank. Courthouse News reported last month that 20 Democratic state attorneys general, including Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell, opted to skip a recent White House roundtable on combating fraud, claiming the invitation came too late. It would be a boon to American taxpayers if Democrats joined Republicans in advocating for reforms to various federal programs intended to make it more difficult for fraudsters to get their hands on the money in the first place. End of editorial. Now turning to sports, Major League Baseball, and the Red Sox mailbag. Given the state of the Sox roster, why is Boston carrying three catchers? Pecking order has been established at team's backstop position by Max Cirillo. We're more than one-third of the way through the season, and things haven't gotten any better for the Red Sox. Can the club still turn things around? And with so many key players sidelined, why have the Red Sox settled on the roster they're carrying right now? We answer your question in today's Red Sox mailbag. Why is Mickey Gasper on the team? Never mind catching. By Jay Baum. Why is Gasper on the team? You could make a case he's been one of Boston's best hitters this season. Entering Saturday, Gasper was hitting .306 with a .740 OPS in his first 20 games in the majors this season. He's been even better when facing right-handed pitchers from the left side of the plate, and he earned his call-up after starting the year with a .296 average, 6 homers, 27 RBIs, and a .947 OPS in 28 games at AAA. Considering how punchless the Red Sox offense has been at times, Gasper has legitimately made a difference. He's been so productive that for a while Red Sox interim manager Chad Tracy played him at designated hitter over Masataka Yoshida even after Roman Anthony went down with his injury. Theoretically, freeing up an everyday lineup spot until he later decided the better plan was to start Gasper at catcher instead. Which leads to the second part of your question. Why is Gasper catching? It probably has a lot to do with the fact that Carlos Navarez or Connor Wong have both been having difficult seasons at the plate. Navarez is the best defensive catcher of the bunch and has been great against lefties, but Wong has been playing his time really drying up. In Gasper is catching regularly. What is the point of rostering Wong? By Yuri Malua Law on Twitter. Candidly, I'm not sure. Entering Saturday, Juan had only played in 6 out of a possible 15 games since May 19th. And one of those, he came off the bench as a pinch runner. And in 2 of the others, he started as designated hitter. At this time, it's safe to say he's been surpassed on the depth chart at catcher by both Gasper and Navarez. And other than being a right-handed bat and a change-of-pace backstop, he doesn't have an obvious role. So why is he still in Boston? It probably boils down to there is not being any better options. And other healthy position players on the 40-man roster currently in AAA are Nate Eaton and Christian Campbell, both of whom have exclusively played outfield this season, and the infielder Sung Che Cheng. Of the three, Eaton would be the obvious candidate for a call-up given that he bats right-handed and came into the weekend batting .291 with 5 home runs and an 8.822 OPS. But unless the Red Sox could play him at third base, the only spot he could realistically start is designated hitter. And it's not likely he'll sub in for one of the starting outfielders often enough to justify him being on the bench. At least Wong can play catcher from time to time. As for Cheng, he could play either shortstop or second base. But since he bats left-handed, having him Marcelo Meyer and Anthony Siegler on the roster together would be redundant. So For now, Wong remains, though once Anthony, Nick Sogat, and Romy Gonzalez come back, his spot on the roster could become untenable. What's the mood in the organization around Christian Campbell's development? What does he need to prove in AAA to make it back to the big league roster? By Todd C. Like with Eaton, Campbell's path back to the majors is basically blocked. Unlike last year, where he broke camp as the starting second baseman but bounced around the outfield and even dabbled at first base, this season Campbell has exclusively played in the outfield. Considering the Red Sox are struggling to find playing time for the outfielders they already have, Campbell wouldn't be a candidate to play regularly anyway, where exception may be a designated hitter. Of course, if Campbell can start hitting and prove he can be a difference maker in the majors, then the Red Sox would need to figure out a way to get him in the lineup. But right now, it isn't happening. Entering the weekend, Campbell was hitting .227 with two home runs, 19 RBIs, and a .665 OPS in 49 games at AAA. To put that into perspective, Campbell hit four home runs in 19 games at AAA at the end of 2024 when he was called up to Worcester near the end of the season. And last year, he had eight home runs and a .799 OPS in 73 games after being sent down. The obvious difference between Campbell at his best and Campbell today is he just isn't driving the ball the way he used to. He actually got off to a decent start batting .294 in April, but even then it was a lot of singles. Since the start of May, he's been trending downward, batting .164 since then, with only five extra base hits over 22 games. Campbell has proven he can produce at a high level before, but right now the guy who set the minor league ablaze 2 years ago is nowhere to be found. Is Tristan Casas in the witness protection program? Where is he? From Brian S. The good news is Casas is on a catastrophic knee injury that ended his 2025 season has basically healed. Tracy said recently that they'd reached a point where nobody is really talking about the knee anymore and now is focused on his left abdominal strain he suffered swinging earlier in the spring. The last update we've gotten on Casas came on May 27th when Tracy said he was nearing a point where he could resume swinging. The knee is okay, just still doing rotational stuff for the side. And I think he's getting closer to maybe starting some light swinging progression, Tracy said. Once Casas starts swinging, it will take some time before the progresses to a point where he could potentially be activated. So fans probably shouldn't expect to see Casas in Boston anytime soon. But if he can avoid any additional setbacks and rejoin the team during the second half, he could provide an immediate and badly needed power boost to the Red Sox lineup. And that's all we have time for today, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for listening, and we hope to see you back here again next week.